I'm still gonna swear around you. If you're holy, you can take it.
That was Rec Small Speakers on Expensive Stereos doing Rain, pre-Dead Sea stuff. Let's see, we heard Matthew Young doing Inflexion. Oh, I got to be quick about this. Surface of the Earth did Shadow Report, Natural Information Society with more excerpts from Perseverance Flow. Willie Nelson doing Merle Haggard's If We Make It Through December. Sten Hjarta did Man Are Integjord for Atvara Ensemble. And John Cale and Terry Riley doing Church of Anthrax from Church of Anthrax. Electric Rubaiyat covering If I Were a Carpenter. Gotta go. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM online at WFMU.org. Thanks for listening, everybody. My name's Scott. I'll see you next week. Stay tuned. Tectonic is next.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. I'm really excited to play an interview for you today. We're going to be talking about amateur radio. You might know amateur radio by another term, ham radio. There are amateur radio operators in your community, wherever you live. They're all over the world, this community. And we're going to be speaking with one of the best known amateur radio operators around. His name is Thomas Witherspoon. I thought it'd be great to talk with Thomas about amateur radio because, as you'll hear, this is an example of a technology that is actually good. It's good for people. It's fun to use. It's fun to learn. There are so many positive aspects about this technology, and it helps counter this somewhat depressing news that we hear week to week about other kinds of technology, the big tech platforms, stuff coming out of Silicon Valley that operates from a very different perspective, has a different kind of agenda. This today is a positive show. I am a fan of amateur radio, and Thomas Witherspoon is going to explain why you should be a fan as well. There's one other aspect about this interview that's really important, and that is a particular experience that Thomas had back in 2024 when Hurricane Helene came up and just wrought terrible destruction in the area where he lives, which is in the mountains of western North Carolina. And as you'll hear, Thomas describes, his amateur radio skills were a real lifeline. That was incredibly important for him, his family, the other families who live in his community. And so that's just another layer of why amateur radio is important to know about. And maybe if you feel inspired, maybe even to look into learning it yourself. If you are interested in links to Thomas Witherspoon and some of the posts and resources that we talk about during the interview, you can find them on the Tectonic website. That's tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Thomas Witherspoon here on Tectonic. Thomas Witherspoon, welcome to Tectonic.
Hey, thank you for having me here.
It's great to have you on the show. You're an amateur radio enthusiast living in the mountains of western North Carolina, and you're well known within the amateur radio community, in large part for your website at qrper.com. That's qrper.com. I'll put a link to that on the show notes. And I'm really excited to talk with you about amateur radio and why it's important, especially because of what you went through in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene in 2024, which we'll get to. But first, I want to start with something you've written, which is that having a radio is like having a superpower. Why is that?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, amateur radio, I think a lot of people don't even really understand what it is. We are people who are licensed. We take a test and we're licensed by the FCC or whatever other, you know, body in whatever other country, you know, administers tests and does all the communications regulations. We're licensed so that we have privileges over the radio spectrum to communicate and to experiment and do some really interesting things, from voice to, we still do Morse code. And in fact, Morse code lately has been going through a complete renaissance. And a lot of digital modes and just a, you know, a wide variety of communications methods. Amateur radio operators usually make contact with each other. We experiment. The cool thing about it really is it's, if you think about it, if you kind of deconstruct it, it's like the world's largest decentralized communications network that relies on no corporate infrastructure, no nothing like that. You know, it's all kind of homegrown grassroots, peer-to-peer. And we've been doing this for like over a century, amateur radio operators have. When I say that it's a superpower, it's because, you know, this show is all about technology and about, you know, different, how things change people, how they change how we communicate. And a lot of communications technologies that are deemed, you know, kind of like old school get passed over, people forget about them, and they kind of move forward. And you realize that a lot of the communications methods we use today rely on infrastructure. Infrastructure we pay for, subscriptions, all those things. Like, yes, we can communicate across the world now. Anybody can do it pretty much anytime they want to, if they want to, with any one individual almost. Almost everybody has a mobile phone. But when those things stop, you don't know what to do then. And when you have learned how to become an amateur radio operator and you have radio gear, it's all designed to work off-grid in a network that we run as individuals and as communities and clubs. So we're not reliant upon this other infrastructure that everybody uses and we use, but we have another means of communicating.
Now, just to make sure I have my terms right, amateur radio, is that equivalent to when you hear about ham radio? Is that exactly the same thing?
They're exactly the same thing. Ham radio is kind of, we're called hams, and that's like a bit of a nickname that's been around for a really long time. But we are amateur radio and ham radio operators are the same thing.
Do you prefer to call it amateur radio? Is ham not a nice thing to say anymore?
You know, it's no, I don't, you know, I think we all call each other hams. But when we're speaking with the public, like just public that don't really know what we're doing, we usually say amateur radio operators because at least they have a little more context in that.
Right,
they're just
right.
Saying we're hams, you know. But really, like, I mean, I think you hear both just as equally.
Okay. And so if you're transmitting, you have a transmitter at mm-hmm. home, you're speaking, or you could shift into Morse code at some point. Is that right? You can go either or?
Yes. So much like anything else, some operators have, so for example, me, I'm an amateur radio operator that likes to focus on low power communicating. So using 5 watts of power or less. So like less than most people use for their, like their bedside lamp, right? it's way less than that. And I tend to focus on the HF part of the spectrum, which is the part of the radio spectrum that's not line of sight, like your mobile phone is, Wi-Fi routers, Wi-Fi, all that stuff is all line of sight, which is the reason why when you go around a corner or you live in the mountains and you travel around, like you'll lose your signal because line of sight's been disrupted. With HF communications, your signal actually bounces off layers of the ionosphere and comes back down to Earth. And that's how you're able to make really long distance, like 2,000 or 5,000 mile communication easily, depending on the time of day and the frequency. And I like looking at that stuff. I do these days tend to use Morse code as my mode, my preferred mode. I used to do a lot more voice. Some people love voice and really don't care for Morse code, and that's fine too. Some people really only do digital communications. And in fact, some of those really focus on digital communications that are more like off-grid networks, almost like they try to form communication networks, almost like old school bulletin board systems that we used to have back in the modem days, or almost things that are like off-grid over-the-air blogs and things like that. There's just a wide variety of things. And people, you know, amateur radio operators are also into mesh networking like Meshtastic and, you know, a lot of those technologies that you can, you know, anybody that's accessible to anyone. So it's a little bit of everything. It just depends on what your goal is and what excites you, because amateur radio is all about experimentation and exploring. And it's a really, as a community and as a what people would call like a hobby or a pastime, it's got to be one of the most diverse that you could possibly get involved with.
Okay. And I have another very basic question. This shows you how inexperienced I am. How does amateur radio relate to shortwave radio? Because sometimes you hear about, I've got a shortwave radio and I'm listening to broadcasts from Europe or whatever.
Yeah. So it's very related. So first of all, my call sign, my amateur radio call sign here in the States, at least, is K4SWL. And I picked that call sign there. You can do vanity calls where you pick your suffix of your call sign. And that one stands for shortwave listener, because a lot of amateur radio operators started out, especially my age and older, started out life listening to shortwave radio, because shortwave radio is basically usually referred to the broadcast side of things. So people who are listeners and radio enthusiasts who want to try to capture these distant signals through the ether. You know, back in the day, like when I was in high school, middle school, there were a lot of Cold War broadcasters out there, and it was chock full. You could get on the radio, and I could tune a radio in my bedroom in Hickory, North Carolina, prior to the internet or anything like that. And I could listen to Radio Moscow, Radio Havana, Cuba, NHK Japan, Radio Australia, the BBC World Service, Radio Netherlands, just tons and tons and tons of stations. And these days, shortwave radio is still very viable and very interesting. There are a number of stations you can listen to, like spy stations. You can listen to utilities of various types. You can hear airline pilots talking on it. There's a really healthy pirate radio segment of the shortwave radio bands with some awesome creative stations that are out there that you can listen to. So that's shortwave. However, amateur radio operators, like a lot of them, that's what they cut their teeth on. They got interested in just the dynamics of radio, how it worked, especially shortwave, where, again, the signals are bouncing off of the ionosphere, so you can hear really distant stations. Unlike you can with, you know, FM and AM, typically FM, you're just hearing stations just in your region, maybe within 100 miles, depending on the type of transmitter site. AM radio, if you ever listen in your car, if you still got AM radio in your car, at nighttime, tune around and you can listen to stations all over North America at night, because at nighttime, those AM signals bounce off of the ionosphere and come back down. It's really fun and kind of fascinating. Well, shortwave radio is even a little more predictable. Like there's a more range in the spectrum. So I know that like on a certain meter band, I can hear a certain part of the world at a certain time of the day. With amateur radio, it's the same thing. It's the same spectrum, different allocations of it, because you're not interfering with broadcasters, with legal broadcasters. But we can use those to talk to each other. So, for example, a few days ago, I actually was using my radio and made contact with, I had a 4-foot antenna, so like a little whip antenna on my radio with a little counterpoise wire, which is like a ground wire for it. I had a transceiver, which is basically receiving and transmitting. It can do those sort of in tandem. And I was at a park near Durham, North Carolina, and I made a contact with a buddy, somebody I knew in England, with 400 milliwatts of power. So like less than half of 1 watt with a 4-foot whip antenna. Now that was a pretty good catch. It was like almost like 9,000 something miles per watt, I think I calculated. And that was a pretty good catch. But in general, that does give you that the shortwave bands, the HF bands, give you access to those sorts of things.
Okay, since you brought up equipment, let's talk about that. If someone is going to get involved and get their starter kit for amateur radio,
yeah,
you've got a transceiver, I heard you say. I know there's an antenna involved. Just give us the basic essential components to what you need in order to send and receive as an amateur radio operator.
Okay, so first of all, I could take this down a really deep rabbit hole, but
that's why I said the starter kit.
yeah, there you go, the starter kit. So first of all, I would say that there is no better time to become an amateur radio operator, because I got my license in 1997, and my starter gear was used, mostly used, like a used radio, and I think I paid $700 for it. It's called an ICOM IC735. It was probably 10 years old at that point. And, you know, when you start to invest in that, you need a radio, you need an antenna. You can build the antenna. You can build the radio, for that matter. There are kits out there, so you can build them if you're good with a soldering iron and some instructions. You need a power source, and you need usually an input device. So if you're going to use voice, then you need a microphone or a Morse code key or a computer if you're doing digital modes. And then you need all the little accessories and cables that go in between there. And then I'd say even above and beyond that, you really need some way to log what you're doing. The license doesn't require it, but it is a really good practice, so that when you make contact with someone that you've logged, that you make contact with them and what your signal strengths were and maybe any other comments you had. But today, with $700, just what I paid for the radio alone back in 1997, those are $1997 too. You can actually buy a fully assembled HF radio with at least like five HF bands that it covers, which is a pretty good bit, for under $200 now. And you can go less than that. And in fact, if you're willing to build it as a kit, you can probably spend as little as $90 on that. That's just like, I would have never believed that when I started in the world of amateur radio. So technology's gotten a lot more affordable. It's a lot even more open source. And there are a lot more places you can go to find a wide variety of radios. So radios are no longer this like barrier of entry, where they're this expensive thing that you have to invest in. And again, antennas, you can buy them or you can make them. And by the time you finish with the study for an amateur radio license, which is not a very difficult exam for most people to do, especially the first level, there's three levels. There's a technician, general, and extra class. The technician and the general, there's a lot of common sense in there, a lot of rules and regulations, so you know how to operate, what to do, how to be safe around radios and understand about RF safety and that sort of thing. And then there's like a little bit of kind of cool science and engineering and stuff that you learn too. And it's worth taking the exam just to learn those things.
How long does it take to do the study and take the exam and get licensed, do you think?
So if you go in and you're kind of technology minded, a little engineering minded, you can probably pass your test by cramming for it. I would say that the better way to do it is to actually get, especially for the first two, for me, it was like the first two exams, I just learned so much and really enjoyed the study material that you do want to study and you do want to understand it when you go into it. Because when you get a radio, if you haven't really been paying attention, it can be really confusing because those don't come with the same kind of manuals like your iPhone would or something where you can just like look up a YouTube video. Lots of YouTube videos out there, but like the combination of gear that you can put together is there's a wide variety of it. You know, for example, I'm really into portable gear. I really like, right here as I'm talking to you right now, I have this little small, like I guess you'd call it like an EDC bag that holds my tablet and some other things in it. And I have a full HF radio in there that I can hold in my hand and put up a little antenna and climb up to a summit or go to a park or in a parking lot when my wife's, shopping at a thrift store or something, I can like pull that out and make contacts with it in Morse code. I really love portable gear. Other people like kind of what I would call like contest grade gear, where there are aspects of amateur radio where people try to collect all the countries they can. And they will invest some serious money in their antennas and their radio gear to do that the best way that they possibly can. So there's just a wide variety of ways that you can invest in it and a lot of wide variety of interests.
And is the portable gear light enough that you could just throw it in a backpack and take it wherever you go? How heavy is that?
The radio I have in my pack right now weighs less than 1 pound.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, it was designed to be light enough that you could hold it in your hand and operate and not have any fatigue doing it. So that was really the goal. This particular radio is called the Elecraft KH1. And you can someone can do a search on that and see what it looks like. It's just a small handheld radio. I have actually, when I was first testing this radio and doing a review of it and everything, I went to a summit here nearby. I do a program called Summits on the Air. There's some radio activities that people like to do. Summits on the Air is one of them. Parks on the Air is another one. That's probably the largest activity in the world of amateur radio today is Parks on the Air. Islands on the Air. There are a lot of little on the air activities where you go out and I take my radio, I go to this entity, a summit, a park, whatever it is, an island, and I'm activating it by calling CQ, which means like, hello, I'm here, let's make contact. And there are networks in place so that people know there's like spotting networks. So people are like, oh, Thomas is on, Mount Mitchell right now. This is the frequency is on, let me make contact. And so they'll do like the sort of the on-air equivalent of a high five. We send each other our call signs, our signal reports, a few pleasantries, and that's it. It's just kind of quick. And I took that KH1, that handheld radio, to a summit here in Western North Carolina and made contacts all over Europe and the West Coast using 5 watts of power out of that handheld transceiver. And I think there's just people that don't even know that that's even possible wirelessly and with something so modest. And when people see me doing this in a park or on a summit or on a trail or something, they're always kind of blown away. Usually they'll ask me, the first thing they'll ask me when they hear the Morse code is they'll ask me if I'm a spy. I get that so often. And I kind of think, man, I'm like a really conspicuous spy if I am.
Well, in addition to all of the fun and enjoyment and learning and so on that you can get from becoming an amateur radio operator, there's an aspect to that skill that's really useful. I'm trying to think of a word that's even more intense than useful. I mean, urgently useful or essential.
Yeah. Life-saving.
Life-saving.
At times.
That's right. And I'm bringing this up because of your experiences, as I said before, in September 2024 with a giant hurricane, Hurricane Helene, that came in from the Gulf and barreled up into the east coast of the U.S., but not coastally, which is where hurricanes usually hit. It actually went into the mountains where you live and wreaked severe havoc on communities there. Tell me about your experience as this hurricane approached and hit, and just afterward as you were at home with your family.
Yeah, so we're not strangers to the idea of a hurricane, maybe the outer bands of a hurricane coming into our area. Usually the hurricanes are along the coastline, as you were saying. In the mountains of North Carolina, I'll be honest with you, we have boring weather, like normally very boring weather. When meteorologists started telling us about Hurricane Helene, when it was just a storm system down in the Gulf and lower, they were saying, you know, this storm's going to rapidly intensify, and we think there's a possibility that it's going to head up, you know, up the Gulf, intensify, and plow up through and possibly even come through western North Carolina. And that's exactly what happened. It was really good predictions. And here where we are, we had had a system come through a couple days before Helene that dumped quite a lot of rain. So our ground was saturated already. What really happened when Hurricane Helene came up, we all, my wife and my kids, we all slept in our living room, which is kind of structurally the most sound part of our house, the night before, kind of with an abundance of caution, really. I thought it was probably unnecessary. But around 5 o'clock, we wake up and the storm is just raging outside. And we had power at our house, mainly because earlier that year, my wife and I finally invested in a PV system or a solar system for our house. And at the last minute, like they had a sale on the battery systems, they said, you know, we can give you these for like 40% off. And my wife and I said, okay, let's just do it. Because we always wanted batteries. We didn't think we could afford it. And we didn't do the normal cost-benefit analysis. But let me tell you, during that storm, we did the cost-benefit analysis and it was worth it. Because we still had power, but the power had been off already at 1 o'clock in the morning in our neighborhood. Our community, we know each other up here. We became very tight after the storm. But in our area, between about 7 and 9 o'clock, we know a couple of small tornadoes that came through the area, super, super high winds. And so trees were snapping all around our house. We couldn't even really get out of the house until around 11 o'clock. It felt unsafe to do it until then because winds were so strong and so gusty and bending the trees. And it was apocalyptic. It completely changed the way the land looks around our house. We checked in with neighbors. The roads were all blocked. Power lines were tangled up in trees that were tangled up in rubble and debris that had come down from the mountains. They were covering the roads. It was like to call it a mess is such an understatement. It was crazy. You couldn't take any car anywhere. And then all of us on our road, we tend to be pretty self-sufficient people because we live fairly remotely. So most of the people on our road have a chainsaw or two at their house. But even then, and I was using a chainsaw, you had to think really carefully about it because our 911 system went down. We didn't have 911. And even if we could call 911, there was no way an emergency vehicle could get to us. The only possibility would have been a helicopter. And they were busy doing other things then because it was such a mess after the storm. And on a communication side of things, like what we noticed immediately was the cell phones. When I first woke up, I checked on my phone. I was able to get a weather map showing me where the storm was around 5 o'clock. But by 7 o'clock, mobile phone systems were down because probably those cell phone towers had already lost power and they were on backup power. And I thought post Katrina, which was a long time ago, I thought post Katrina that systems would be so robust that this really wouldn't be an issue anymore. But it very much was. We didn't have mobile phone service for a really long time after that.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Thomas Witherspoon, amateur radio enthusiast and operator living out there in the mountains of western North Carolina. And as you heard, when Hurricane Helene came through, just a really unusual event for a storm like that to go all the way west in North Carolina. Power is down. As he said, the cell phone towers are down. What do you do at that point? Well, we're going to hear in the second half of the interview how amateur radio acted as a superpower, as Thomas says. If you're interested in the resources and links to Thomas's writing that we've talked about during the interview, go to the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm. That's tectonic.fm. And you can explore more there. For now, let's go ahead and listen to the second half of my interview with Thomas Witherspoon here on Tectonic. All right, so what we have here is an apocalyptic scenario. The roads are totally impassable. There's no power coming from a centralized authority. There's no cell phone access. And I should say, I know some of the details here because I read in your QRPR blog post about, as you called it, the aftermath was the name of the post. And you have a whole series. And I'll put a link to that in the episode notes because you have photos as well and go to a bunch of detail. But as I read it, there were two things that you had that were really important. One was that solar system that gave your house power, which, of course, is it's due to being off the grid and having that battery system, as you said. And the other was having the radio.
Yeah.
How did those two pieces of technology help your family and allow you to help other families?
So it was incredibly important. I think it was then I kind of wrote that amateur radio in this storm was really like, if you were an amateur radio operator, it's like you had a superpower, because I have a radio in my house. I have a lot of portable handheld radios that look sort of like you would see a public service person use, you know, like a walkie-talkie. But I also have a station in my house that's hooked up to an external antenna that's more like a base antenna. And I'm able to easily hit most of our local repeaters. And, you know, repeaters are just a way, it's a transmitter. It's on top of usually on top of a mountain or a high point on top of a building or something that handheld radios can hit. And then it rebroadcasts your signal to a much wider footprint than you'd be able to do with just one radio. I'm able to easily hit the Mount Mitchell repeater, and Mount Mitchell is the highest peak in the eastern half of North America. And there's a repeater up there. It's called the N2GE repeater. That repeater was used very, very heavily to pass emergency traffic during the storm. Now, on our road and in most of Asheville area and the Swannanoa Valley, there was like no communications, of course, like cables not working. There's not even landlines were working. When the 911 network's not working, you know it's really bad. So there was zero communications. And after that first day, I went around and started collecting information from neighbors. Well, we did the first day too, but really the second day is when the community came together after we kind of licked our own wounds for a little bit. We got together, we made plans, we figured out how to take care of things, how to help everybody out, who needed help, who needed medicines, who needed things. I could go back to my radio and hop on the Mount Mitchell repeater, where there's a net controller, just one person primarily, and sometimes another person that would help them. And they would manage all the traffic and take notes and make sure people were communicating with each other and reaching out to the property authorities and emergency communication centers and that sort of thing. And I had this main line into that network for my radio. So like literally my radio is connected to the most important people that I could possibly talk to. I remember once we had a community meeting on our road. We had those every day. FEMA and other organizations were bringing in supplies, and they were taking them to the bottom of our road, 2 miles away, 1,000 feet of elevation lower than us, and lots of debris and things we had to get through to even get there. our road had deteriorated so much from all of the water erosion and stuff like that, from like raging rivers kind of pushing up both sides of it, that our road was almost impassable and almost crumbled away at one point until a group came in from Indiana to fix it. But anyway, we're having that community meeting and they wrote up this dream list of things we needed, which didn't include a lot of the things that are in most relief packages, like baby formula and diapers and just a bunch of things like that. We wanted like bar oil for our chainsaws. We wanted different chains that we could replace out. We wanted fuel. We wanted coffee. We wanted some very specific things. And they all said, you know, it would be ideal if they could just bring these supplies in by helicopter. That would have sounded totally absurd the week before to even think that we would be requesting a helicopter drop of something. But during the storm, helicopter drops had become pretty routine, but no one had a way to really request it themselves. And we had two candidate sites on the road that we picked out. And I thought, well, let me just hop on the radio after this is done, after this meeting. And so I hopped on the radio. I asked Net Control the question. I said, I don't know who to ask about this. I don't even know if it's possible, but could we possibly here on our road have a helicopter drop of material? And I've got a list of things we need and two candidate sites where maybe a helicopter could land. And someone actually broke into the conversation that was at our local emergency communication center, which is actually our fire department, Swannanoa's fire department. And he said, Thomas, we'll take care of that for you tomorrow. And that was it. Now, if I was just someone with like an email address of someone to contact, right? Like how would I have ever gotten that through? And then phones, like they didn't have phones either. So like it literally amateur radio was this emergency communication network that was not only effective, it was efficient. And so we had the radio in the house that was tuned to the repeater, which was so that we could communicate with the wider world. We had people call us asking, they would have a list of people saying, we have some wellness checks. We want to know if this person's okay, that person's okay. Once they identified, you know, I'm on there, I'm on this road. These are the people I can reach out to, because they were cut off from everybody else. And then we also had requests for wellness things like, you know, please let so-and-so know, here's their phone number, that so-and-so's okay. You know, please check in on this other person and that sort of thing. So amateur radio operators need a license in order to legally operate. However, during a communications emergency, and this is all in all of the exam material, those rules are out the door, because you do whatever it takes to have effective communications. And being the kind of amateur radio operator that accumulates things over time, I had quite a few extra handheld radios. And so I set them up on one frequency for simplex operation, just point to point, locked in the frequency, made it really easy for people. And I distributed those down our road so that we had like our own little community net every day at 7 o'clock in the morning and 7 p.m. so that we could coordinate. Because without communications over a 1 mile span of road with only like maybe 18 households, it's difficult to communicate and pass the word. It takes a lot of time. And let me tell you, rumors started immediately when there was no communications. There were all of these rumors about what was happening in town. Like I've heard that there were mass looting and all this stuff, and none of that was true at all. But like people worried, and those things turn into these miscommunications. And so the radio made all of that, it brought everybody together. And worked out really effectively. It just so happens, I somehow convinced my wife to get an amateur radio license years ago. She agreed to do it, and I think she didn't regret it now. both of my daughters, they were teenagers, both of them have their amateur radio license too. It was something they did during the pandemic when they had a little bit of time. All three of them and me, there was always someone stationed at the main radio at the house. And then anytime we left, we had handheld radio so we could communicate back and past traffic. And so it worked out pretty effectively. And at the end of the day, amateur radio operators, like one really big component of it is doing your community work and being able to understand how to pass emergency traffic. That's a really integral part of, it's not all just like the fun on the air activities that we like to do. Those things are actually, in a sense, a way to practice emergency communications. That's sort of our reason for doing these things. I can go to a summit when it's 32 degrees and blowing wind and set up a radio station and communicate with somebody in Europe. And if you can do that there, then you can do it pretty much anywhere. And this gave us an opportunity to actually practice those things. And I should say that the Mount Mitchell repeater has such a massive footprint of people that can communicate with it, that the main person, Dan, who ran the emergency communications net on the Mount Mitchell repeater, was actually located in Statesville, North Carolina, which for me, driving there would take me about an hour and 45 minutes. He was well outside the area where there was a disaster. He had his lights. They may have flickered. That was all they had. They had no infrastructure problems there. So it was a perfect place to stage and have people ready to do things to help us. And it just worked really, really well. And after the, you know, after the disaster, you know, a lot of the neighbors wanted to have another way that we could communicate like that. Because once that was over, of course, I took away the radios. There was no more communications disaster, but they wanted to have a backup plan. And we've already been working on other radio methods to do that now.
It strikes me that community turned out to be incredibly important in the aftermath of this storm. I mean, yes, you had your solar power and you had your amateur radio kit and multiple kits, but the relationships that you had and that you then deepened with your neighbors, it sounds like that was maybe the most important component of all of that success.
It was. I've told people, don't believe what you see in these like doomsday prepper shows where in a time of a disaster of some sort, you separate yourself from society and you get in a big bunker and you have your own supplies and you rely only on yourself. If you do that, you're just missing out on the efficiency and resilience that you get with community. Like it was everything for us. Like on our road, you know, I knew people on the road. Some people I just waved at, I didn't know them that well. Other people, you know, we'd stop in and visit sometimes. But being in a rural remote area, you know, on pretty large properties, a lot of us have, we just don't see each other a whole lot. And getting together as a community, we realized just like the amount of resources we had on our road, on our small road with, like I said, maybe 18 households that were there during the storm, we had like a really good mechanic. My buddy Rob runs a shop in town. He's an incredible mechanic. We have a physician's assistant. We had a trauma nurse. We had three different people that can operate track hose and two people with tractors. We have a machine shop on our road. I mean, just a lot of things like that. And when you start to bring those community resources together, you're able to do a whole lot. And we found that we really didn't need to use a lot of the food that they were bringing in. That's the reason we were saying, don't send us food, send other people food. We're good here. A lot of us have chest freezers. Some of the very best barbecued ribs I've ever had were during that storm because, you know, of course, people's freezers were starting to thaw out and we had probably three really big community barbecues that were amazing and uplifted the spirit. My wife said at one of our meetings, she feels like she traded her trees for friends and family. And that's really kind of how it felt. It was devastating, still devastating today, like to look around and see the destruction, but we're a much tighter community now because of this.
On this show, of course, the connection that immediately comes to mind is the billionaire tech CEOs who've very publicly been buying up plots of land in New Zealand and other places in order to build these doomsday bunkers because they believe when there's some emergency that they're going to hole up in their, you know, basically a hole in the ground and they're going to live their best life. But you're putting the lie to that, Thomas. You're showing that with a little bit of modest investment in learning and some equipment, you can build a much better chance of survival with community.
Yeah, 100%. So FEMA, you know, there were all these stories around. It was an election year, right? And there were all these stories around about how horrible FEMA was and things. And FEMA was out there really early in the game. They did everything they said they were going to do for us. Like we have only really good experiences with them. But when they first came up, which was probably around day three or four or so, we had as a community pretty much cleared all of our roads and driveways of trees and debris. Our whole road, we had cleared it so that you could at least get ATVs and UTVs through and later larger vehicles. The problem was we actually had sections of road that were crumbling away and you just couldn't put large vehicles on those. But we had opened it up and I remember the FEMA people came up and they're like, wow, you guys like really have it together. And it's all because we all work together. Just to clear my driveway is about a tenth of a mile long. There were probably five sections of multiple trees that had fallen across it. Some of them were 130-year-old trees, hickories and things. And I'm very good with a chainsaw. But like, if I would have done that myself, it would have taken me a week and a half to get to the bottom of my road. But we had volunteers, we had people in our neighborhood, we were able to knock out all of that on everybody's road. By like day five, especially, we had full clear access to everything. We didn't need to wait on somebody to come and take away all the debris. We did it all of ourselves. And it's just because we got together as a community to do it, because we weren't going to wait around for someone to come do something for us. It was just easier to get together and have a good time at it too. Like, we watched after each other and make it work.
All right, let's talk about some specific tips. I saw a talk that you gave where you went through some of these suggestions for how to be prepared in an emergency or in a natural disaster. You talk about having plenty of cash on hand, because obviously the credit card readers go down, have plenty of water on hand. There was one tip that I was interested to see where you said, make sure that you have Wi-Fi calling on your phone enabled.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yeah. So we, not only did we have power at our house and we never lost it because of just the fortune we had of installing our solar system and battery system earlier that year. But another thing we had done, we have never had rural broadband at our house. Like, we've had, I think, DSL, where I would have a maximum of about 0.2 megabits up and about 1.5 to 2 down. That's what we had for years and years and years. We did invest in a HughesNet satellite system. They installed a high-speed geosynchronous satellite at the end of 2023. And we thought, you know, we'll give this a go. And it doesn't have great ping times and things like that because it's a geosynchronous satellite, but it worked. And our house, we literally turned our porch into, we called it the Witherspoon Internet Cafe, because people were there all time of the morning, during the day, at night, and we let them use our Wi-Fi. We let them charge all the things they wanted to do. We had more than enough power for all that stuff. If anybody needed anything baked or whatever they needed, we could do it, right? But people would come up and they were using their computers to file insurance claims, to communicate with family members, to file their FEMA applications for things. And the ones that had Wi-Fi calling installed were able to make phone calls. Now, I had not done that with my own phone. And the reason why is because our internet had always been so crappy that if it tried to reach out to the Wi-Fi network, you would get a really garbled phone call, because it would always default to that instead of defaulting to the network, right? So I never installed it. But it's something that you actually have to do while you're connected to a cell phone tower, because it reads some of the like IMEI numbers or something on them.
Oh, meaning you have to do it before the cell tower goes down.
Yes.
Before the natural disaster happens, you got to do this.
Yep. You can't do it over the internet, just like through a Wi-Fi connection. It has to be connected to whatever carrier you're with, one of their towers, because that tower has to read the information off of your phone at least once to enable it. So I found that, like, without having that, I couldn't receive text messages, because we had no other mobile phone service. And without text messages, I couldn't do two-factor authentication for like my bank, my insurance company, you know, all these things. And it made it really difficult to get around those, even if I had a path to get around them. So like, the moment that I was able to go into town and go to like a site where I think Verizon and some of these other carriers had set up like sites where you could get cell phone service, the moment I did that, the first thing I did was install Wi-Fi calling. So do that in advance. You would be surprised how many things you need two-factor, and you should need two-factor authentication, right? Like, you really do need to have that installed in pretty much anything you do that's important. But that was a key thing. Also, having battery banks and things like that you can take advantage of when you are able to go out and go somewhere where you are able to charge something. All of our devices tend to use like USB power supplies and things, and you want to have those in place. You need to have clean water during a natural disaster like this, which, if you were in an area that was flooded, I mean, I know people like in really nice neighborhoods in Asheville that all those neighbors were going, they had like made a path to local creeks so they could go get water to dip so they could flush their toilets, because Asheville was out without water for a really long time. Because of that, we actually had water at our house because we have a well, and normally we're without water during any kind of power outage, but because of the solar, we still had well water. So we never had an issue with this. But that same water that you're pulling out of a creek, to be honest, has had bodies in it. It's had, you know, vehicles that have been swept into the rivers. Like, no amount of filtering, I think, is going to take out like fuel and oil and things like that, they're probably in that water for a long time. So you really do need to have potable water at your house, enough to last you maybe a week or something like that. Another point I kind of make is, because I've always been into practical, kind of pragmatic preparedness. And even in our situation, which I consider to be really extreme, life was starting to normalize a bit after about 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, we could get into town. We were able to get into town probably after week one, and businesses were starting to open again. There was some level of internet connectivity. You could even use like a debit card in some gas stations and that sort of thing. But week two, usually if you can make it to there, you're going to start to have food supplies and those things start back up, I think, in pretty much any area. So kind of think of keeping, you know, a couple of weeks worth of non-perishable foods. You don't have to fill your whole basement. Just kind of think through it a little bit. And then again, if you're in a community of people, you end up sharing stuff anyway. Like we never had an issue with food. In fact, we probably ate better than we did like normally because we were emptying our freezers.
Okay, we're just about at time, Thomas. This is fascinating. I have one more question. That is, there's somebody out there listening right now who says, okay, I'm sold. I need to get involved in amateur radio, both for fun, but also for emergency preparedness. What is the first step that they have to do? You've given us the model number of a possible radio, but I mean, where should they go to learn, you know, buy this, learn this, here's the test. Where's the starter place?
I think a really good one is the ARRL, which is our Association for Radio Amateur Operators here in the U.S. They have a website and study material. Keep in mind, all of the test questions and the answers are in the public domain. So these are multiple choice tests. The test is 35 questions. All of that stuff's out there. There are some really good programs and applications that are either from free to paid to help you learn, you know, how to take the test and the material in the test. But I'd say that the ARRL is actually a really good point to start. There are also a load of YouTube videos out there. There are full classes on the tests. If you want to have like a classroom experience, you can watch that are on YouTube. So there's actually a lot. There's a huge amateur radio component on YouTube as well. So I'd say between those two places, you have a really good place to start. Of course, we have a lot of material on my website, mostly about field radio operating and that sort of thing. But always reach out. Amateur radio operators are very friendly. They like to bring people into the fold and help them out. Also, maybe look and do a Google search or some kind of search to find an amateur radio club near you. And just go to one of the clubs. They probably have testing sessions, and they're usually eager to help you and bring you in.
Okay, and ARRL is ARRL.org, and your site is QRPer.com. That's QRPER.com. And I just want to say thanks, Thomas Witherspoon. This has been fascinating and educating, and I hope you'll be back sometime.
My pleasure, Mark. I'd be happy to do that.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the last few minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with amateur radio operator Thomas Witherspoon, who's there in the mountains of western North Carolina. He went through a scary experience in 2024 when Hurricane Helene came through the mountains and did a huge amount of damage, including to his own neighborhood. And you heard how important amateur radio was to coordinating the response and passing messages. It was also interesting to hear him say that before communication was really established, rumors immediately started. Rumors and misinformation. And I didn't get into it with Thomas during the conversation, but I was thinking, ironically, that's exactly what the tech bros bring about with their digital platforms when their platforms are working. And so the same thing that we get when amateur radio goes down is exactly what we get when the big tech social media platforms are up. And maybe you noticed during the interview the several occurrences of opposites between amateur radio and the big tech platforms. You know, big tech is centralized, amateur radio is decentralized. Big tech is owned by totally unethical, monopolistic corporations. Amateur radio isn't owned by any corporation. As Thomas said, there's no corporate infrastructure at all. It's just enthusiasts who are learning on their own, and then they link up with each other. And in times of emergency, they are using that technology to help each other and help their communities. It's also interesting to think, when a natural disaster happens, what is the technology that you're going to rely on, that you can really depend on? It definitely is not the big tech platforms. As Thomas pointed out, you know, electricity goes down, cell phone towers go down. Where is everybody's, you know, Facebook or whatever at that point? It's gone. So all of these municipalities and towns and communities that are putting their communications onto Facebook or Instagram or WhatsApp, they should make sure that instead they have some capacity to communicate with people with amateur radio. That's about all the time I have for today. I do have some homework for next time. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google and maybe get on amateur radio. And thanks very much to Thomas Witherspoon for coming on the show. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. And for the outro today, I've got a very special piece of audio for you. This was put together by our very own Todd Mazursky, who did a great job, as always. And I want to tell you what this is, because Todd Mazursky himself is an amateur radio operator. He recorded amateur radio transmissions on October 29, 2025, which was a day after another terrible hurricane. This was Hurricane Melissa, made landfall in Jamaica. And so what you're going to hear is a collage that Todd put together of a number of amateur radio transmissions. And as Todd describes it, operators were sharing news, checking in on friends and family, making phone calls, and giving firsthand accounts of the devastation. So in other words, all the things that you heard Thomas and other amateur radio operators were doing in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. This was happening also in Jamaica after Hurricane Melissa. So thanks to Todd Mazursky for putting that together. And by the way, you'll hear at some point a brief mention of Hurricane Helene if you listen carefully. So let's go ahead and listen to that. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. And as always, if you have comments, I'm at mark@tectonic.fm and the website with resources for anyone who wants to learn more about amateur radio is at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Here is the audio collage put together by Todd Mazursky. Have a great week, everybody.
This is Kilo 1 Yankee Oscar, your net control station for the Hurricane WatchNet. This time we'll read the latest intermediate advisory issued by the National Hurricane Center of Miami at 8 a.m. today, Wednesday, 29th of October. Melissa continues to move over eastern Cuba and will soon emerge into the southwestern land.
WYCM, good to hear you. N0GJW. I'm not sure if your home was on the Han River side or the Westmoreland side. Anova got trashed there. Power is down. If you're trying to contact that side, Lime cell services seem to be up. Your cell seems to be down completely there. A few of us are on frequency here, just doing some phone patches there. Over.
347.
Roger, Roger. Your name is Charmaine. The message is her mom is okay, all right?
Copy 100%. Okay, on it. Okay, Charmaine said thank you so much. She was so worried. She said, okay, that's good news. She feels better, and she's glad you're okay too there, Roger.
Hello, Radio 615 Hotel Oscar listening.
Alpha Bravo 2 Foxtrot in there.
Hey, Alpha Bravo 2 Foxtrot in there. It's devastation here, my friend. Left, right, and center, right across. It's rough. Everybody got flooded out. It doesn't matter anywhere that the water can come in your house, under the door, any crevice or the window. Yeah, that's what happened, my friend. But we survived, and I'm on a hillside, man, and there's no leaf left on any trees. It's total devastation, over. I am going to try to see if I can touch base with them. Then I can see if I can pass some welfare traffic. Over.
QSL. All right, that's fine. I understand what you guys are going through. We went through this last year with Hurricane Helene up in the mountains of North Carolina, so we understand exactly the process and how long it can take.
But at least, you know, we're alive and we could fix them things, Roger.
Roger, my friend. Once there is life, there is hope. We have to look at it like it's a new beginning, my friend, because there's a lot of work to do. We just have to put hands and heart together and help our neighbors. That's what we got to do, my friend.
And that sound means it's time for another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here with this program every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks so much for joining me. We are going to start. I'm going to start tonight's show with a couple of tracks or a couple of bands from a compilation album that was released a few years ago, in the early 2000s, let's say, called Maximum Prog. I discovered this album a while ago. Maximum Prog, 16 rare gems from the golden age of British progressive rock, which I guess explains it, right? I stumbled onto this record a while back, and it contains music by a lot of bands that I'd never heard of. Most of them, I think, on this album, are groups I hadn't heard of. And as the title implies, it's early stuff, sort of proto, what I might call proto-prog. So I'm going to play a couple of the groups that I discovered on that compilation, not necessarily tracks from that compilation, but bands from that compilation. So I'm going to play two pieces. The first one will be from, and they're both English, the compilation is English bands, early 70s English bands. First band is Sweet Slag. Lame name, don't blame me. They were from Luton, UK. And then I'm going to play a track from a group called 930 Fly. 930, like the time, the hour of the day, 930 Fly. And then we'll just see after that. Here we go. We'll be right back.
Stop and score.